resolution comes at a moment during the summer of 2003 when there's a great deal of attention to questions about marriage and family.
I auditioned for Will and Grace, but I was too gay for Will and not gay enough for Jack, which is a common problem for me. I'm never the right kind of gay to play gays in mainstream Hollywood.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Sodomy law silences a dissident Uzbeki gay journalist, American attorneys defend queer family values, and gay movie lovers swoon over an indie actor's memoirs. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending August 16, 2003. Despite international protest, openly gay dissident journalist Ruslan Sharapov was sentenced this week by a court in Uzbekistan to 5.5 years in prison for sodomy, homosexual acts with underage teens, and running a brothel. Journalists and human rights activists are convinced the Uzbek government is using the sodomy law to punish Sharapov for his critical writings, as it attempted to do with failed drug charges against him last year. Of the 15 former Soviet states, only Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and Turkmenistan retain the Stalin-era law criminalizing homosexual acts between consenting adult males in private, a law which violates the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. Uzbekistan's sodomy law provides for up to 3 years imprisonment. Reportedly, it's rarely prosecuted, but commonly used by police as a threat to extort money from gays.
Sharapov pleaded guilty this week after dismissing his attorneys, a remarkable turnaround after widely proclaiming his innocence, including in an open letter directed to U.S. President George W. Bush. He said he had to plead guilty for his safety and that of his mother, and human rights activists believe his confession was coerced. They'd reported earlier that he'd been tortured and threatened by his jailers since his arrest in late May. A United Nations investigator had previously found torture to be systemic in Uzbek jails and prisons. Sharapov's detention also denied him needed medical treatment, but the court refused to arrange his release on bail.
Sharapov's trial is widely viewed as far from fair and impartial. Despite his objections, it was closed to observers and presided over by a judge Sharapov had previously publicly criticized. Not all witnesses were heard, and the alleged underage victims gave contradictory testimony, while a key witness actually supported Sharapov's innocence. Forensic evidence did not support his guilt. Groups objecting to Sharapov's treatment include the New York-based Human Rights Watch, London-based Amnesty International, and Paris-based Reporters Without Borders. The San Francisco-based International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission called for his immediate release.
Beijing police this week announced their arrest of a suspect in the murders of 7 gay men. The as-yet-unnamed suspect reportedly confessed to those murders, plus that of a school classmate who may have been his ex-lover a decade before when both were in their teens. The more recent victims he's said to have contacted on the internet and invited to his apartment.
There's been a guilty plea in one of Canada's most notorious bashing murders. The beating death of gay Aaron Webster in Vancouver's Stanley Park 2 years ago that sparked a new awareness and activism on anti-gay violence in the area. The convict was 17 at the time and so was tried in youth court, and his name is barred from publication. In exchange for his guilty plea to manslaughter in youth court, prosecutors dropped their effort to have him tried as an adult. That means that when he's sentenced in October, he'll face no more than 3 years in prison, which in adult court could have been as much as 25 years.
Gay bashers were also arrested in Sweden earlier this month for an assault on the Pride March in Stockholm. There may have been 5,000 marchers celebrating Pride, but some 30 skinheads attacked the parade with fists and bottles. One marcher was hospitalized for a serious but not life-threatening head injury. The attackers were believed to be associated with a nearby counter-demonstration by about 200 people protesting the Pride March in an action organized by the right-wing National Democrats. That group's leaders claim that the Pride marchers had attacked them first, but police saw it differently. They immediately arrested 2 men for attacking the Pride parade and may have arrested as many as 15.
A violent incident also marred this week's Pride celebration in Brighton, England, as two men punched both members of a lesbian couple on a busy street outside a nightclub a few hours before the parade began. Sussex police believe it was a hate crime, but are still seeking witnesses to help them find the perpetrators. Otherwise, Pride in Brighton was a great success, with no arrests, injuries, or other problems except for extreme crowding on the trains into town. Billed as the greatest show on earth, the parade, ceremonially opened by Brighton Mayor Gene Lepper, was three times the size of 2002's, and the free festival in the park drew 90,000 people, up one-third from last year. Along with games, including a handbag-tossing competition, the festival featured its first recruiting effort by the Sussex Police, with the help of the Gay Police Association. Among numerous officials sending good wishes to the event were Prime Minister Tony Blair, Liberal Democratic Party leader Charles Kennedy, and Conservative Party leader Ian Duncan Smith.
Arrests were apparently made on both sides of an altercation in Copenhagen's Israel Square this week. At issue was Danish gay Carsten Damsgaard's appointment to serve as ambassador to Israel. The Israeli government approved his selection in May, and the Israeli embassy in Copenhagen still maintains that Damsgaard's gay orientation is no problem for them and that he and his partner will be welcomed in their homeland. But Denmark's own religious right objects, and Christian fundamentalists and Israeli resident Joni Noor's group Pilgrim's Convoy staged a protest demonstration, praying for Damsgaard's removal from the embassy. Some other Danes found the homophobic message so offensive that they intervened, trying to drown out the demonstrators. Police intervened in the ensuing altercation.
In a gentler action, some 3,000 people rallied at a shopping mall in Sao Paulo, Brazil, early this month, following a security guard's intervention when a male couple kissed there in July. More than 100, and possibly as many as 1,000 of the demonstrators went on to join a gay and lesbian kiss-in at the Freikaneka Mall's food court. The rally was organized by the pride group Corsa, whose president Lula Ramirez told reporters, "This was less an act of protest and more of a demonstration of affection in public." The mall's manager said the security guard had acted properly because of how intimate the original kiss had been, while saying gay and lesbian shoppers were welcome. In fact, the mall took full advantage of the publicity offered by the demonstration, decorating the walls inside and out with giant red lips, lighting the food court in colors, disco style, and setting up a DJ who played songs about kissing. That paid off, as 35,000 people visited that day, compared to an average of 25,000.
For those whose relationships extend beyond one kiss, the South Sydney City Council this week approved by 7-2 the creation of Australia's first official domestic partners registry. Modeled on London's, where the 500th couple was recently registered, the South Sydney registry will be open to unmarried couples regardless of gender. While South Sydney Registry per se carries no legal rights or responsibilities, it can serve as evidence of a relationship. Activists are calling on other local governments to follow suit, as has happened in other nations.
In the U.S., San Francisco's Board of Supervisors voted unanimously this week to extend its extensive recognition of domestic partners to those who have registered or contracted a civil union in any other jurisdiction. Another vote and the mayor's signature are needed to make it final, but those should be no problem. New York City had previously adopted a similar measure.
The state of California saw two other significant advances for gay and lesbian partners last week. The State Board of Equalization, the panel that reviews tax laws, voted 3-2 to extend to domestic partners registered with the state the same status as married couples for inheriting property. Previously, a homeowning partner's death had meant a reassessment of the property, leading to an extra tax burden that often forced the survivor out of the home. However, the move to extend the marital exemption from reassessment to registered partners could still face a hurdle at the State Office of Administrative Law, since some believe it would violate the voter-passed state constitutional amendment restricting California's recognition of marriage to one man and one woman.
The California State Supreme Court struck down by 6-1 an appeals court rejection of a lesbian co-parent status. While the San Diego case before the court had some unusual features, the appellate ruling was viewed as a threat to about 10,000 existing second-parent adoptions by California gay and lesbian partners. Those are adoptions by which a co-parent gains legal status while the birth parent still retains legal status. The state high court's affirmation of those adoptions was welcomed by activists as further strengthening their legal validity. validity. There have been similar affirmations by appellate courts in 7 other states and Washington, D.C., with another 17 states granting second-parent adoptions to same-gender couples in trial court or by explicit legislation.
And finally, in the face of right-wing proclamations that homosexuality is against nature, it's refreshing to hear a sharply dissenting view. Zoologist Clive Bromhall has been pumping his new book, The Eternal Child, at the Edinburgh Book Festival. Starting from the commonly held recognition that humans remain more physically immature longer than other primates, he extrapolates into the social realm by labeling as infantilism the human continuation into adulthood of childlike traits, including a relatively mild-mannered temperament, cuddliness, and especially playfulness and creativity. This infantilism he sees as a product of evolution that sets humans apart from other primates. He told reporters, "We've known for years that homosexuality is linked to a playful, creative character. Homosexuals excel as artists, thespians, and other playful, mimetic professions. Being playful is at the heart of being human. It's something that should be celebrated. You could say that homosexuals are at the pinnacle of human evolution."
That's News Wrap for the week ending August 16th, 2003, written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Dean Elzinga.
There's an ugly duckling story behind the scenes of some of the best-known queer films of the 90s. Find out how an openly gay actor became a handsome prince later in the program. Association, the largest association of attorneys in the U.S., passed a resolution calling on states to recognize gay and lesbian second parent adoptions and to allow those couples to adopt unrelated children together as well. This Way Out's Brian Goebel reports from San Francisco.
The vote by the ABA's governing body received very little attention in the mainstream media, but the 410,000-member organization's resolution was hailed by queer rights groups. It followed a California Supreme Court ruling okaying second-parent adoptions, a legal procedure that allows same-gender parents to adopt their partner's biological or adoptive child.
We're talking about a relationship between two women, often, who have planned to have children together.
Joan Hollinger is an adoption law expert at the University of California in Berkeley.
In many ways, though, there's a very close analogy between a lot of the second parent adoption circumstances involving certainly lesbian couples and more traditional step-parent adoptions. In some ways, these second parent adoptions are closer to the core nuclear family circumstances that very few children in our society are now getting the benefit of, with only something like 25% of all children growing up in families consisting of their mother and father married to each other.
The ABA's resolution also applies to unmarried heterosexual couples. Its passage means the organization can start lobbying state legislatures to approve laws legalizing second parent adoptions. Currently, according to the Human Rights Campaign, only 7 states in the U.S. guarantee second parent adoptions, along with the District of Columbia.
This resolution comes at a moment during the summer of 2003, when there's a great deal of attention to questions about marriage and family and personal and intimate relationships concerning gay and gays and lesbians. But in fact, the ABA has been on this trajectory for some time. I don't think it received as much media attention because there were a number of other much more controversial issues on the ABA's agenda. And this was almost a ho-hum resolution. As far as I could tell, there was no opposition and certainly no vocal opposition. And it passed with a simple voice vote at the House of Delegates meeting earlier this week. What it means, however, is that it adds another very renowned professional voice to the growing chorus of professional organizational support for second parent adoption and for the interests of children in having their relationship to the people who are actually serving as their parents be given full legal recognition.
Other groups who've gone on record in support of second parent adoptions include the American Academy of Pediatrics and the American Academy of Family Physicians. The ABA support will be critical in states which have been adamant about maintaining laws against gay adoptions. The state of Florida, for example, has argued in court that it prefers to place a child in a household with a mother and father. Its ban on gay adoptions is currently being challenged in a federal appeals court, which is expected to rule soon. Similar battles are also underway in some European countries, which have supported gay marriage but stopped short of allowing queer couples or individuals to adopt. Hollinger says more progress on gay adoption is being made in the U.S. In particular, the California Supreme Court ruling has given activists much hope.
The California decision recognizes that as part of existing statutory law going back in this state for almost a century or more, it is possible when individuals jointly intend to parent together, when they consent to parent together, and when a court finds that their proposed joint parenting is in the interests of the child and goes ahead and approves the adoption, that this is okay, that this is not illegal, that it's not strange, but rather that it is a very positive thing for children and their families.
For This Way Out, I'm Brian Goble in San Francisco.
This is Margaret Cho, star of Notorious CHO, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international radio magazine for all our sexually diverse communities.
A pioneering actor in the independent film world, Craig Chester made his name in what's been called the queer new wave cinema of the 1990s. His role in the drama Swoon scored Chester a 1993 Independent Spirit Award nomination, and he's also appeared in such genre-defining films as Grief, Frisk, David Searching, and Kiss Me Guido. It's all chronicled in Chester's memoir, Why the Long Face? The Adventures of a Truly Independent Actor, published by St. Martin's Press. This Way Out's Steve Pride chats with Chester about his queer life, movie making, and reconstructive surgery.
Let's start with your childhood. When did you know you were gay? You are gay, by the way.
I am a gay. Yeah.
Are you professionally gay?
I'm professionally gay. I'm openly gay.
When did you know you were gay?
I didn't know I was gay, but I knew that I was different when I was like 5. As early as I can remember, I knew that I wasn't like the other boys. I didn't have a word for it until I was 19. But before then, I just knew I was attracted to boys, you know, in high school. But when I was a kid, it was more, I was really effeminate. I was like a real sissy when I was a little boy. I was very, very effeminate and very implicated as gay. And now I see like little boys like me and I'm like, oh, you know, you can kind of see. And the interesting thing about the book is that as diverse as the gay community is, everyone, black, white, old, young, rich, poor, they all relate to the childhood stuff in my book. And it's made me realize that the thing that we all have in common, as diverse as we are, is that we all had the same childhood in some way.
You've been open since the beginning of your career.
It is a totally different reality when you come out from the beginning. It's an economic reality, too. That's why people don't do it. I mean, I did it sort of expecting that and seeing where it was going and thinking, oh, well, eventually there will be something like a Will and Grace and there'll be something like a Queer as Folk. And I could see that down the road. But I wrongly assumed that, you know, me and Alexis Arquette and David Drake and other people like me would be sort of taken along for the ride, and we weren't. We all sort of sit around and bitch about that because we feel like we sort of paid our dues to the cause and we've struggled and fought the good fight, and now that gays have sort of arrived, we're sort of left out of the process. Like on Will and Grace, you know, Dan Futterman playing Will's boyfriend, and Dan's a friend of mine, and he's a really great guy. But, you know, his heterosexuality has been very much lauded in the press, and it's a crucial part of him being cast in that role. The audiences at home feel more comfortable because then they think, oh, it's all just make-believe. I auditioned for Will and Grace, but I was too gay for Will and not gay enough for Jack, which is a common problem for me. I'm never the right kind of gay to play gays in mainstream Hollywood. I mean, I've gone into auditions where other people are like, could you be a little bit more colorful? Like, you can say more gay. It's okay. It's an adjective, you know? But yeah, I'm often not the right kind of gay to play gays. I've had this happen too, where I auditioned for gay parts and I was too sexual, or I played that aspect of the character in the audition and turned people off, because I think Hollywood's comfortable with gay characters and people playing gays as long as we make them laugh, do their hair, or decorate their homes. But like, if there's anything else to do with being gay, like sexuality, I think it frightens people.
It reminds me of whenever you ask an actor about, oh, in that movie, the kiss with the other man. And it's always, well, just as I was telling my girlfriend slash wife this morning, my face was raw, because I suppose no one ever shaves in movies. It was rough. You know?
I love comments like that. And, you know, my first movie in Swoon, the guy who played opposite me, Dan Schlackett, was straight. And when we were shooting the movie, he really had a problem with the kissing. And, you know, all the other stuff is fine, but, like, there's something about the two-men kissing thing is really freaks people out. And every single movie I've done, like, from Swoon to Grief to Frisk to Kiss Me Guido, it's like straight audiences are fine with gay sex. They're actually fine with it. But the second there's intimacy or there's love between the two men, there's lots of shifting in their chairs, coughing, people walking out. And I've seen this happen over and over and over again. And even lately, I just was in this movie that was at the Hamptons Film Festival called Bumping Heads. It's a Brian Sloan movie. And there's this whole backroom sex scene and totally straight, wealthy audience in the Hamptons. And they're fine, like, watching the gays have their anonymous sex in the back room. And then later on, I have this moment with the other lead in the movie who I'm in love with, and I take his hand and I just hold his hand. It's just this quiet moment where I'm, like, in love. And people got up, they walked out. And then this woman afterwards at the party, she was like, yeah, I've never really seen that before. It's like you guys were, like you were intimate. And that freaks people out more than gay sex, because we're expected to have sex and we're expected to be promiscuous, but we're not expected to love, which is why the gay marriage thing is so controversial. People are fine, you know, with the concept of gay bathhouses, but like a gay marriage is so subversive and so radical. And I really think that's the last territory, that's the last frontier in terms of mainstream acceptance, is them accepting two men loving each other. That's really the most taboo thing.
Big surprise for me in your book is the meaning of the title. I was just laughing my head off, and suddenly there's this heartbreaking story that reveals why the book is called Why the Long Face.
Yeah, I grew up with a genetic disfigurement in my face called Long Face Syndrome, which is kind of rare, and it doesn't really hit you until you're about 11 or 12. And basically what happens is the bones in your face start growing down instead of forward. So I didn't really have a chin or jaw. My teeth came in. There was no room for them to come in. I mean, it's like your face is just sort of warps into this deformed, long version of what it should be. And so when I was 18, I had a year's worth of surgeries to rebuild my whole face. Everything except my forehead basically has been rebuilt because I was in a lot of pain. So it was really traumatic. I mean, it was a year of my life. I had three major operations. The first one was to rebuild my upper jaw. The second was to rebuild my lower jaw. And then they rebuilt the roof of my mouth. So, I mean, I told that story in the book because it's sort of a defining moment in my life. And it informs how I see the world so much, because I went from having one face to having the face I have now. And when I was 19, and I saw how people treated me differently, which I expected, but I was surprised at how differently people treated me with my new face, like at the Gap or like waiters, or I mean, it was such a lesson in how important looks are, and at the same time, how unimportant they are.
This has been a conversation with out gay film star Craig Chester. His memoir, Why the Long Face? The Adventures of a Truly Independent Actor, is from St. Martin's Press. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Come with me to a mirror. Tell me, please, who could be fairer, could be more handsome. Very handsome. Pretty is pretty good. Cute's real sweet.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Dean Elzinga, Fensberry, Graham Underhill, Rex Walkner, Brian Gobel, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Thanks also to Paul Jaffe. Holly Neer and Mary Travers sang Home is Where the Heart Is from the Peter, Paul, and Mary album Lifelines. Handsome was performed by David Downing, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can also listen to This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. There's a link at our website, thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded through direct charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. To find out how you can help keep This Way Out on the air and get some queer audio history and timeless music in the bargain, please visit our website at thiswayout.org, email us at tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. And thanks to AlternaBid and the Stonewall Society, you can still bid on some terrific items in an online auction to benefit This Way Out. Look for the This Way Out auction area at AlternaBid.com. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks very much for listening on CFRU Guelph, Ontario, Trans FM, Broward County, Florida, Free Radio San Diego, California, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. We invite you to stay tuned.